City Limits, brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9 a.m.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment,
to transport and planning and housing issues,
to privatisations and our utility services,
to building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Hello and welcome to City Limits. Now, this is a special International Women's Day program. I'm Lynn Drummond, and today I'll be speaking with Sandra Buckley, Lisa Darmanin and Jackie Woods on creating a secure financial future for women with limited or no superannuation. We will also discuss the problems of our highly gender-segregated jobs market. Joining me in the studio is Sandra Buckley, Executive Officer for Women in Super, and by phone, Lisa Darmanin, Trustee Director of the industry supergroup HESTA. We'll be joined later in the program by Jackie Woods, Executive Manager Engagement of the Workplace Gender Equality Agency, to discuss the agency's latest reports on the segregated jobs market and the proportion of employers with gender equity strategies. Welcome, Sandra and Lisa.
Morning, Lynn.
First, Sandra, I'd like to speak to you. The Women in Super mission is to create a super system with gender bias. Without gender bias, sorry. It is well known that women have half the super savings of men, yet live an average 5 years longer. What is WIS doing to improve women's retirement prospects? And who do you work with to achieve this? And have you made a lot of progress?
Thank you, Lynn. And first of all, the very fact that you're even asking that question and having me here today tells me that we are doing something right, which is that one of the things we do is we work hard to make sure that women are not forgotten in the super debate. So we do this by talking to a lot of organisations, such as the industry bodies. We work with the superannuation funds. We work with service providers, academics, researchers, women's organisations, to make sure that when we put together our submissions to government on issues that relate to women's retirement outcomes, we have some body of evidence and research to put in with that, so that when we make requests, they're not just requests that are coming from us, but they're actually evidence research-based analysis that we've done. And we sincerely hope that we keep things going by having our Women's Super Summit and campaigns, and that you don't forget and continue to take us on board and ask us questions about women's superannuation.
And there's a Women's Super Summit coming up this year?
We had one at the end of last year. So we have a biannual Women's Super Summit where we invite the thinkers, if you like, and the women from the industry to get together and discuss and debate the topics and challenges that arise with trying to improve women's retirement outcomes.
And is there one later this year?
No, we'll have the following one the year after.
There's a lot of talk about the gender pay gap, but what's been done about the so-called super gap? Can you explain that?
Not much, Lynn, is the short answer to that. We're definitely not getting any closer to closing the pay gap, and the same applies to the super gap. So in order for us to be able to close the gender super gap, we need government policies that are focused on improving women's superannuation savings and therefore their outcomes at retirement.
And also, can you describe the progress that's being made? You had a research project called Ageing Agendas, and it's seeking to discover the effects of so-called shocks that occur at particular points throughout a working life and the impacts they have on retirement outcomes.
That's right. There's a lot of talk at the moment about extending the age at which people are eligible for the age pension and at what point in which they can receive their superannuation, and the need, of course, for people, therefore, to work longer. But we're finding out that this is not necessarily an option for many women. So a preliminary paper from that particular research project that you referred to, which is based on analysis of the HILDA data, found that the people who can actually work longer are, in fact, high-income earning men who've got good health and are able to adjust their working hours. So not women, who are the very people that we're trying to help by improving their retirement outcomes.
Well, this is something that's been a pattern for a long time now, I guess.
Yes, and I guess that's one of our worries. So we know that one in three women will retire in poverty, And we don't see anything currently changing at the moment that is going to stop future generations retiring in poverty. So unless we make some systemic changes to the actual superannuation system and recognise that women have unique working patterns and that they have got a different workforce participation to men, then we aren't actually going to change their retirement outcomes. They will always retire with less than men.
Is there anything at all that that government could be doing about this, but they're not?
And one of the recommendations that came out of the Human Rights, the Australian Human Rights National Inquiry into women and the return to work after pregnancy, and also in the Senate Inquiry into improving women's economic security in retirement, was that as a country we look at caring responsibilities. So we know that 80% of caring is undertaken by women. We know that the majority of women take 5 years out of the workforce to care for children, and when they return to the workforce, they return on a part-time basis. So we'd like to see some discussion and debate analysis around what can we do to compensate those women. They're obviously telling us that they want to take that time off. They don't have the care in place to enable them to return to the workforce on a full-time basis, or they may not want to. So we as a country need to see what we can do, whether that is to incentivise, from a tax perspective, the second income earner, whether it's to provide quality, affordable childcare that women can access to enable them to work more hours. There's a number of solutions to the problem, but we as a country just haven't got there yet in the debate. And that's one thing we'd like to look at going forward.
Is WIS actually getting more and more involved in those changes in policy or new policies?
All the policy work that we do relates to improving women's retirement outcomes. So if, for example, improving retirement outcomes means increasing workforce participation or means improving childcare, then we will definitely put a submission into government and we'll have a discussion or a debate on it at our policy committee.
There was a Senate inquiry report that came out April last year, which made 19 recommendations. The WI submission to the inquiry said it would be a betrayal of the women of Australia if savings are made through adjustment to the excessive concessions available to high-income earners, predominantly men. And the savings are not directed to measures which will make a meaningful contribution to improving super outcomes for women and redressing gender bias within the system. This inquiry was into the economic security of women. Do you have any comment on that? Did you agree quite...
Certainly applaud the report and the recommendations that came out. We think Senator Jenny McAllister and her team did a fantastic job, and it's just a shame that none of those recommendations have yet been taken forward. We definitely stand by our statement. The recent super changes did make some adjustments at the upper end, but the savings were not redirected to those at the lower end by making a meaningful change, as you said, Lynn, to the women's retirement outcomes. Instead, the savings were used to improve the budget deficit. So we'd like to see some sort of meaningful change at the lower end. We know that women predominantly are the low-income earners, and we'd like to see some change made to improve their retirement outcomes other than just simply rebating them the tax that they have paid on their compulsory superannuation payments.
And just on those recommendations, one of them highlighted the anticipated rise in the number of older Australians in the private rental market, which is a big issue, of course, here in Australia, and the insecure tenancy confronting many older renters. The aim would be to determine how policies designed to assist these older Australians to remain in their home could take better account of and also accommodate the added difficulties for older people who want safe and secure housing. And more broadly, of course, renting in the private rental market is just not affordable for many of them. In the light of this so-called affordable housing crisis, what policies do you think you'd like to see that might work?
I mentioned earlier, Lynn, that one in three women are retiring in poverty, and statistics that we have coming out at the moment are telling us that one in four retirees by 2036 are likely to be dependent on the private rental market. So the Senate inquiry did make some suggestions about some ideas and further analysis that could be undertaken, such as, for example, developing innovative government initiatives to encourage private sector development of affordable housing options. And I think we need to remember that for the majority of women in retirement, their house, if they have one, is their main asset in retirement. So there's a very, very strong link between their sense of security and living in that home. And without the ability to move into a more affordable house, then they're simply not going to be able to do that. We also know that a lot of women are dependent on the age pension, And we'd like to see the age pension, some sort of analysis around that and how women can continue to receive the age pension, especially the current generation of retirees, and be able to afford to rent on the private rental market, because we know that with the age pension they simply are struggling to do that at the moment.
Oh, thank you, Sandra. I'll now turn to you, Lisa.
Good morning, Sandra and Lynn.
Hi, thank you for joining us, Lisa.
Happy International Women's Day.
Yes, yeah, same to you. Impressed by your background. I see you have a lot of experience working with women in jobs where financial insecurity is a reality. Can you tell us more about your experience in that and the reactions that you're getting from women you've spoken to?
Sure. Well, I guess the majority of my working life has been spent as a campaigner in the social and community services sector. So some of your listeners might be aware that in 2010, we launched a campaign to close the gender pay gap in the social and community services sector across Australia. I was involved in the campaign in Victoria and Tasmania. And the basis of that campaign was trying to address the issue that because women who work in social and community services, along with many other industries, are underpaid, and the basis for that underpayment is due to their gender. And we ran a case in the Fair Work Commission that agreed with that point, and that they were effectively suffering a care penalty because they worked in a feminised industry, and their work was less valued because it was women's work. And in terms of my conversations with many of those workers over the years, obviously it's highly frustrating, and most women in that industry do the job because they love it, not for the money, but they should not be disadvantaged both in their working life and then in their retirement as a result of choosing to work in a highly professional industry because they are motivated by things other than money.
I should say that
we did win that case. Okay. I talked about the issues, but the Fair Work Commission agreed with us and that and agreed that the gender pay gap needed to be closed and awarded pay increases of between 17 and 45% to those workers. But that has been phased in over a period of 8 years, and we're about halfway through the phasing of that.
Oh, good. I'm going to talk more about boards and female representation on boards. There was a report that came out on women leaders in the public sector. Can you comment on the main points it made? It said that women still underrepresented at every corporate level, and companies with 25% female boards actually perform more than 7% better than those with male boards. And I wondered what the possible reasons could be for that. And adding to that, the chairman of the board of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, Elizabeth Proust, has called for mandated quotas to get more women on boards, as she doesn't expect 30% of board seats to be filled by women, as predicted by the Institute. Is a quota system the only solution?
Okay, they're big questions.
Yeah, sorry, we've only got a very, very short time, a couple of minutes probably,
yeah,
but you can ignore one of them if you like.
I'll talk very quickly about why boards with women perform better. And there's a number of different research reports that point to this. And I think it's quite logical. Diversity of points of view can trigger different discussions and deliver innovative solutions. You have a wider scope of versatile skills and expertise that you bring to the table, which not only delivers innovation and other points of view, but also better governance arrangements. So, it makes common sense to me. You've got 100% of the population and resources. Why don't, you tapping into that 100% when you're making decisions at every level can only improve the situation, and that's been my experience. But in terms of quotas, this is a discussion I could talk about for a very long time, but I'll keep it short. My personal view is that quotas is the only way that we're going to get change. And I think that is borne out by the evidence. Women are continuing to be underrepresented in business despite the development of clear gender equity targets. Targets are not as effective as quotas. You need a bit of a carrot and you need a a bit of a stick in my view, because otherwise progress is quite slow as we're seeing. And the other thing that I would say is that targets work best, or quotas, when they're supported by programs that create a pipeline of women or talented leaders to choose from. And I should also say that it's not just about women, but it's about diverse groups of women, because women who are Aboriginal, women with a disability, and women from culturally diverse backgrounds also have very disproportionately low levels of representation. So there needs to be that creation of pipeline of talent, training and networking opportunities, which they're some of the things that I've benefited from and that have helped me in developing my board career, and also monitoring programs and scholarships that can help women on the pathways to success.
Thank you. Right, we're going to go next to Jackie Woods, but you're listening here to a special City Limits International Women's Day program on 3CR 855 AM, where I'm speaking to Sandra Buckley and Lisa Darmanin on creating a secure financial future for women with little or no super. We're now about to be joined by Jackie Woods of the Workplace Gender Equality Agency.
Join the International Women's Day Rally on Wednesday the 8th of March at 5:30pm, starting at Parliament House and finishing at Trades Hall for an after-party. International Women's Day sparked the Russian Revolution 100 years ago, and in honour and memory of our sisters then who took strike action over bread, we raised the demand, peace, bread and land. Join us for the IWD Rally on Wednesday, March the 8th, at 5:30pm at Parliament House. Contact the women's team at Trades Hall for more details or visit unionwomen.org.au. The IWD Collective, Victoria Trades Hall Council and the Trades Hall Women's Team are 3CR supporters.
Hello. Jackie?
Hello.
Hello, Jackie.
Yes.
Hi, Jackie. Lynn Drummond here speaking, and this is and Sandra Buckley's in the studio with me. Thank you very much for coming on the program. And, yes, we'd like to hear from you about what's happening with this much-reported, highly segregated jobs market for women, that women are apparently in that big area of the very low-paid jobs, particularly the service industries. And I know the WGEA has done some reports recently on this, and there is a Senate inquiry going into this issue. And wondered if you could talk more about that for us, please.
Yeah, so Australia's workforce is very segregated by gender. Our data shows that people are much more likely to work in an industry that's dominated by one or other gender rather than an industry that's got a more equal balance of women and men. So we find that at one end, women are highly concentrated in healthcare and social assistance, which is a very big industry with over 80% of employees being women. Women are also highly concentrated in education and training. At the other end of the spectrum, mining is the most male-dominated industry. That's got over 80% employees being men. It's actually also the industry that delivers the highest average pay for women and men. Men are concentrated in the other traditional blue-collar industries as well, like construction and manufacturing. And utilities, but also at an occupational level across industries, women are much more likely to be working in administrative roles compared to, for example, trades roles that are concentrated by men. And then there's what we call vertical segregation, which is where we see men, of course, dominating those senior ranks, those senior management roles.
Is this something that can be, I mean, what do you do? Do you just try and change attitudes? I mean, it's been going on for such a long time now. What's the solution to this?
I don't think there's any single solution. I think challenging attitudes is really critical. You know, people sort of carry quite deep-seated ideas, I guess, just based on what they see around them, I guess what jobs their parents, family may have done. The sort of graduate data suggests that graduates are still going into areas traditional for their gender. But we also actually need to, I think, look a bit more closely at, well, you know, what are the particular barriers to men or women entering particular industries. So I think there is there's some activity in terms of trying to attract women into male-dominated industries, and that's, you know, sort of promoting girls studying those subjects at school, for example, advanced levels of maths that open up possibilities for them to study, sort of STEM-related fields at university. But I think change is a bit slow, and what we're actually seeing is a lot of competition. You know, employers, employers in male-dominated industries, to their credit, are working hard to attract women into their organisations. But at the moment, what we see is competition over a small pool of graduates. So there just aren't enough women coming through into those fields. There's also, I would say, there's not enough action challenging the stereotypes around jobs for men and boys, because I think, you know, if we're to change things for women, we actually need to look at what's happening for men as well. And that's about, you know, redefining some of those caring roles as jobs that can be really great for women and men. Currently, only about one in 10 nurses in Australia is a man. Nursing is obviously a, you know, can be a terrific career that offers great opportunities, and yet I still think, you know, there are deeply held stereotypes that men carry with them that perhaps they're not going to be respected in a caring role, or a caring role isn't suitable for them, or a role that's sort of perceived in that way. You know, that needs to be challenged as well.
Yeah, there seems to be this attitude still. I mean, I've known one or two male nurses, but they are fairly thin on the ground, is that they feel like they're being, I don't know, humiliated a bit by their mates, perhaps, that they're going into an industry which they're not normally expected to go into. And these sort of attitudes been going on for a long time. Yes. Just talking about employers, the proportion of employers with gender equity strategies, I understand, is about 70%. I wondered what the other 30% are doing. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, so our data that we launched, that we released in November last year, showed that, you know, for the first time, over 70% of employers had a policy or strategy in place to support gender equality in their workplace. So, look, it's a, you know, I think it's a positive sign that employers are seeing the issue. In terms of the other 30%, well, you know, that they, you know, probably not seeing gender equality as an issue that's central to their business. Again, sometimes, you know, it's not only the male-dominated industries. Sometimes it's the female-dominated industries who say, well, we've got a lot of women working for us. We don't have a gender equality problem. But actually what we see is that some female-dominated workplaces have big gender pay gaps and big gender equity issues. But looking at the 70%, it's really good that 70% have a policy or strategy in place. But, of course, you know, there's also the gap between having the paperwork in place and the real action and the real lived experience for those employees. So I would absolutely encourage everyone to ask your employer what policies or strategies they have in place to support gender equality. What people can also do, if their employer is required under the Workplace Gender Equality Act to report into the agency each year, that means if they're an employer with over 100 employees and they're not in the public sector, well, their public report will sit on our website. Employees can look it up, but they can see if your employer has a strategy around flexible work, for example, or around pay equity. We would really encourage people to, just raise that with their employer and ask, how that's being implemented, how that could support them, and, hold their employers accountable.
You had I believe you've had two reports come out on the segregated jobs market, one fairly recently. I think it was launched this week. Was it in Perth?
Yes.
Is there anything new? Yeah, anything that's specifically there that you're carrying forward?
Look, that report that we released in partnership with the Bankwest Curtin Economic Centre looked closely at the gender pay gap and how it manifests in different ways. So what an important finding from that report was how important balanced leadership teams are in organisations to gender equality and specifically to pay equity. So what it found was that gender pay gaps are high, as would be expected, when management teams are dominated by men. And then it found that employers who increased the representation of of women in management roles recorded measurable reduction in gender pay gaps, except for those at the very female-dominated end of the spectrum, which was interesting. So organisations with over 80% women in their management teams recorded an increased gender pay gap. So it sort of suggested that you know, in those teams that are very dominated by women, perhaps bias is kicking in there and the rare men are sort of valued even higher or put on a pedestal. So absolutely sort of gender balance in leadership is an important message from that report. Another interesting finding from that report was that gender pay gaps start at the graduate level. So even though the average gender pay gap for graduates is relatively small at a couple of percent, what it showed was that men were more highly represented than women in the top group, say the top sort of 10% of graduates who are earning the highest salaries. Men were, you know, women were underrepresented in that group. So even from that graduate stage, men are accessing the highest salaries available in the market.
Oh, thank you very much for that, Jackie. We have to be winding down soon, I'm afraid. It's been a fascinating discussion. And I'd love to thank, right. I'd like to thank you and my guests, Sandra and Lisa. And next week, City Limits returns to its usual one-hour format, where the topic is social housing. And our next program after this for International Women's Day is a special edition of the Radioactive Show. Happy listening, everyone. Thank you.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.